Here is Barbara Simpson.
Good evening, good morning. This is Barbara Simpson in for Art tonight, and we've got a very interesting subject coming up. And if you have ever wondered, as I have, if there's any relationship between archaeology and mind power, between the role of consciousness in ancient civilizations, was there a role? Is there any connection between extraterrestrial life and life on this planet? When did it happen and how did it affect us? I've wondered about things like that. Our guests are experts in those areas and more. J.J. Hertak, Ph.D., and his researcher wife, Desiree Hertak, a fascinating look at their work, and some of the answers to the questions might just surprise you. We'll talk about that coming right up on Coast to Coast AM. You stay with us. I'm Barbara Simpson. I want to tell you a little bit about our guests. J.J. Hertak, Ph.D., is the founder and president of the Academy for Future Science. He has written, translated, and published over 15 books, as well as commentaries on the ancient Coptic texts illustrating Jesus' scriptures being found in the Middle East. Dr. Hertak is also an anthropologist, archaeologist, and he's studying the findings of the so-called Osiris tomb in Egypt through remote sensing. Desiree Hertak is an international relations expert who brings an interpersonal understanding for those dealing with the feminine. They travel throughout the world to investigate indigenous people and ancient civilizations. They are both with us right now on Coast to Coast AM. Good evening, good morning to both of you.
Good morning, and Barbara, I remember some years ago you with Dennis Richmond here in the Bay Area did such a wonderful job at KTV2.
KTVU Channel 2, that's right.
That's right. Remember just the wonderful impact that you've had on the media up here, and I'm very happy to join you with Desiree this morning talking about these very interesting and provocative subjects.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you, and how nice of you to remember. I appreciate that, absolutely. That was the television anchoring that I did for many years here, and apparently you are familiar with Northern California.
That I am. We're here in Silicon Valley, and this has been one of our bases of operation.
Very good. What is your latest project? I know that you have a new edition of your book of knowledge, The Keys of Enoch, which will be coming out shortly, and I understand that Art will be talking with you about that when that happens. What have you been up to besides that?
I am presently finishing a film entitled The Life Body, which deals with the next stage of human evolution as we look at it in terms of all of the impact from the Genome Project to consciousness evolution to what some people would say are a whole new direction of futurism, where we go from here in the next 20, 30 years. This film will be released. It's already been privately reviewed by filmmakers in Japan mm-hmm. and Europe, and they think very highly of the computer graphics that we have been able to pioneer. So it's very important that this will be available to the radio audience throughout the world in the next month.
And one of the things the film does is it actually takes you on a journey throughout the world. So you see places like Stonehenge, you go to India, you even see small little sneaky scenes of Yanaguni, and of course Egypt. So mm-hmm. it's an overview of all of our work together and a lot of the film footage we've shot during our travels.
Now, you're talking about it, you mentioned human evolution. I think when most people, Dr. Hertak, think about evolution, they think of a fish coming onto the shore and evolving into a land animal, monkeys, apes evolving into humans. What kind of evolution are you talking about?
I'm talking about evolution that is not necessarily the Darwinistic model of everything coming out of the biological ooze of Mother Earth, but rather evolution that is, in my research, shaped by cosmic forces of intelligence that evolves from simple cells to complex cells to society, civilization, technical civilization, and ultimately the control of entropy or destruction, decay, and the dissipation of life. That is to say, I'm speaking of evolution that can, as it were, conquer the limitations of planetary confinement, a type of planetary cosmoanthropology, evolution that reaches out to the stars mm-hmm. and ultimately makes contact with the cosmic family of the higher creation.
Now, this cosmic family that's out there, is that is it sort of the God figure, or are you talking about actual other beings living on other planets?
I'm talking about all of the above. In 1995, in Washington, D.C., a historic conference was held called the Meeting of Cosmic Cultures, and at that time, very select scientists, former members of government, and outstanding journalists got together to discuss the impact of cosmic cultures in space. Mm-hmm. Those that share possible similarities with the human race. And the conclusion was that we would somehow make contact within the next 20-some years, and that was 1995. So if we put into a database all of the new information of what is happening, from recent sightings over Mexico City to anthropological evidences in China and South America, we're seeing a much larger and magnificent picture emerge that suggests the human race is not alone in the universe, and we're going into the sudden realization that we are surrounded by a vast number of cosmic cultures that include also the Godhead or the divine.
You mentioned the anthropological findings in South America and China. What are you referring to specifically?
Let's have my wife take that question.
One of our journeys was actually to Xi'an, which is the ancient capital of China, and that's where the pyramids are there, and there's many pyramids in central China. So that was one of our excursions. Another place, of course, we've traveled throughout South America and seen pyramids in Peru, and also gone to Easter Island, which is a very fascinating area, because we now know that if the water levels were different at some time, Thor Heyerdahl showed us that you could travel from Easter Island over to South America and back. So there could have been this unique migration civilization, which we were also part of our whole cosmology, that we see that man could have traveled easily from the area of China and the Far East to South America. In fact, what we're finding in South America is ancient civilizations older than what you find in North America. There's always been that theory, of course, that they came through the Bering Straits, and it was about the time of Clovis, which is 12,000 years ago, but we're not finding that anymore.
You know, you mentioned the pyramids in different places. I was having a conversation last night with some friends about that, whether Egypt, you know, they thought Egypt was the only place where there were pyramids. And, you know, we got into the discussion of, no, they've really been found around the world at different times, in different cultures. And it raises the question, the interesting question of, where did these people get the idea, A, for the structure of the pyramid, and B, what was the purpose of it? Have you found any more enlightening information about that?
We've found quite a bit of evidence in our own field research and musical testing inside the various pyramids in China, in Yucatan, that is to say Central America, Mexico, as well as in the Middle East, in Egypt, where we were able to bring very sophisticated equipment in the 1980s and 90s and test vibration rates and acoustical properties inside each of the rooms inside the Great Pyramid from a standpoint of 20 vibrations per second up to 20,000 vibrations per second. And we confirmed that there were certain musical cues that the human ear would resonate with, as well as vibratory levels down to 3 hertz that were outside of the human ear range of hearing, that suggest a musical architecture was programmed into these pyramids in many locations. So the pyramids, as we are interpreting our research presently, suggest that they are energy collectors as well as some sort of musical transducers of sound and energy, perhaps raising the states of awareness and consciousness of the human participants of that civilization or society into higher states of creativity.
And there's also the theory that they might have been placed in particular locations throughout the planet, that these are not happenstance locations that people got together and decided to build one there. There's a Lothian man who lived about 1920s to the 1950s, and he traveled all the way from Lothia to a place close to the Bermuda Triangle in Florida to build this place called Coral Castle. And in a sense, it's, many of your viewers probably are familiar with this, but it's very fascinating when you talk about who built the pyramids, how were they built. He, of course, moved 28-ton blocks of coral by himself. So if he could do it, you can imagine there must have been some technology. Now, the interesting thing is we did went go to see this place, and we went with some friends who were thinking of buying it back in the 1970s.
Yeah.
And so they got to find out a lot more than what the normal tourists do. And what they found was he had the entire place set up with copper wires all over the place. And in the center where he would normally do his work, he actually had a generator or a motor. They didn't know what this was. So when he died and the city moved in, the people who took over, they just tore down all the wires. But probably he used a particular type of field to raise, literally levitate, because there's no way a person by himself, and he was alone, could have done that. But he moved to this particular location where he felt that there was a type of energy grid, and then using his own technology, we don't even know how he got that information, he was able to do these tremendous things.
Judging by what I have heard about the Coral Castle and also what you just said, it sounds as though we'll never know either, will we?
Unfortunately, Leet Skellen, the gentleman that Desiree is referring to, passed away without leaving a journal, a book of notations of how he came over on the boat from the Baltic. And for all intents and purposes, we're back to square one as far as that location is concerned. But more to your question, we are doing a lot of work with remote sensing technology. I was trained in anthropology, archaeology, with also the ability to use advanced tools and lasers and radar, looking both from small plane platforms as well as from ground observation crews at these very intriguing temples and pyramids in various locations of our planet.
Now, you mentioned the vibrations, and that was in the Egyptian pyramids, right?
Right. Have We're talking about 3 to 120 decibels, which we found to exist inside the king's chamber. To put it very, very simply, we found that there is a resonance that is part of the pattern of energy in each of these rooms. And if you are able to hit the right sound frequency with your voice as a male singer or with a musical mm-hmm. instrument, the whole room begins to resonate, and it begins to entrain the human mind to experience other levels of consciousness change.
Like what? What does it feel? Have you experienced it yourself?
I have, and I've documented this on film, both in the King's Chamber as well as in the Grand Gallery of the Great Pyramid, where actual standing waveforms of energy were momentarily picked up on film. Energy experiences allowed the mind to see flashes of various pictures, mental scenarios, and then a sense of tremendous peace of mind and tranquility would come as a result of these high peak experiences.
And one of the reasons we think this happens, because we actually recorded this and then analyzed it on oscilloscopes, is the fact that the vibration, even if a person puts out a sound in these chambers, it actually continues to go down the line to get into the alpha wave frequencies. There's a resonance that goes down to the alpha wave, so it kind of puts your whole mind into this alpha state, which is a type of meditative state. And many people, of course, even inside the tomb where you can lay down in the king's coffer, have mm-hmm. had some very unique experiences.
What would have been the purpose of that experience for those people that many thousands of years ago?
Well, I think the interesting thing is that Dr. Hertek, in his book, as you mentioned earlier, The Keys of Enoch, brings out the fact that these star shafts, these air shafts, as they're more commonly called, are aligned with Orion on one side, Alpha Draconis on the other. So this has two purposes. First of all, it actually shows you the entire heavens. It actually ties right back into the Mayan culture, which mm-hmm. is also telling us that on one side of the Milky Way exists Orion, which is what they consider a very positive direction. In fact, the Mayans consider it the father kind of creation. And then the other side, you have Alpha Draconis, which is the concept of the dragon energy, and you also have Ursa Major, Ursa Minor, which is the bear energy. So you have these two things, and of course you have the pyramid sitting right at the center, or in this case the pyramids even in Egypt as well as in the Mayan culture. So with that, when you're in the tomb and you're doing these certain types of frequencies, as a type of initiation, your mind really needs to journey out of the physical dimension, and going through these air shafts or these star shafts, it is kind of like your decision, your initiation to go which direction you are to travel.
In a word, we're talking about a cosmic anthropology, or seeing how certain landforms and ancient structures were used to tap the, what the scientists would call the music of the spheres in ancient times,
mm-hmm.
the fact that there are cosmic oscillations in the universe that somehow are reflected in these great temples and great pyramids. And with the proper sound chamber that is activated, the human vocal cords, the human mental apparatus, all begin to be transformed into higher states of creativity or the experience of ascension. Now, to your earlier question about the geometry of the pyramid, as one sees in most instances the solar rays come down from the heavens, the whole ascension process may look like a prism or a pyramid being reflected from above to below. And so the Egyptians, as well as the Aboriginal peoples, we believe, saw the pyramid as a stepping stone back into the source of light or into the Godhead from which the whole cosmic design would unfold.
So Orion works both ways. It works with the original creation coming down as well as the ascension of humanity going up.
Do you believe that they actually had an understanding of that aspect of it? Or, I mean, were they that advanced to know that?
If you go back to the original Egyptian text, you'll find Orion throughout the entire cosmology. All their prayers oftentimes are spoken about Orion being Osiris. Osiris,
mm-hmm.
interestingly enough, went around and taught the world. And you know how he did it? This is all in legend, of course. He taught through music. So sound vibration was very critical. So we actually say that 6,000 years ago, or wherever you want to place the origin, maybe 10,000 years ago, these people were much more advanced than we give them credit for today.
Now, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Let me just inject. It's one thing to argue this intellectually and academically. It's another to go out and actually get musicians, musicologists, remote sensing specialists to go to these locations and set up the measurements. And this is the importance of where we are with the Academy for Future Science, are taking, as it were, the theories and the questions to task and actually doing the studies of acoustics and employing some of the best musical sound engineers in the world that have worked with the feature films, that have worked with NASA, that have worked independently of academic institutions who do not carry a bias into this research. We have found certain matching musical patterns in all of the geometries which cue in the range of F sharp to A sharp. And so this would suggest that many of the ancient cultures did know something about the human mind, the human psyche, and realized that a certain level of musical vibration could activate the mind into accelerated states of learning.
Have you done this type of investigation of the sound aspect of it in pyramids in other places in the world, and are they the same in terms of the results?
We have done this in Peru. We have done this in Japan. We have done this in China. And more recently, we are doing this here on the home front. And we have been able to build quite an information database on this, which we're now bringing out very, very carefully. And hopefully this can be illustrated in feature films or in documentaries so people can actually see the equipment being deployed, can actually see how the measurements were taken, can actually see the oscilloscopes and the screens showing the biofeedback and the musical feedback systems in each of the rooms and come to their own conclusions. Yes, the ancients were much more evolved than we think in terms of architecture, musicology, and mathematics. And there is a very interesting correlation between what exists throughout the world, suggesting that at a much earlier stage of evolution, perhaps there was some cultural exchange or symbiosis between the Far East and the Near East. In 1969, I published with a well-known scholar, Dr. Wesley Bliss, a document called the Peking Elephant Scapula Bone, which
okay,
is
okay, I'll tell you what, Dr. Hertek, we've got to take a break. Hold the thought right there, and we'll come back, and we'll pick up on that. I'm Barbara Simpson. My guests are Dr. J.J. Hertek, Desiree Hertek. We're on Coast to Coast. Barbara Simpson here with my guest, J.J. Hertek, Ph.D., and Desiree Hertek. Dr. Hertek, just before the bottom of the hour, you started describing something to us.
Right.
Go ahead with that.
Barbara, before the news break, I was telling you about an exciting discovery that was made in 1936. It was an elephant bone found in China. A friend of mine was able to get a rubbing, that is to say a copy, of the Chinese and the Egyptian hieroglyphic script that was found on the back of the elephant bone before the Japanese invasion in 1937. The bone was lost, but the rubbing was kept very carefully by my colleague, and it's very interesting that this is one of the few artifacts that speak of scientific communication between Egypt and Chinese astronomers approximately 1,500 BC, and that communication suggests that astronomers in China and Egypt were in correspondence on a very advanced level. In fact, the picture that accompanies the hieroglyphics speaks of the good god Imhotep, an honorary figure in Egypt connected with the heavens.
Mm-hmm.
And the text in Chinese and Egyptian, and this is important because the bone is written in the two languages, speaks of other planetary systems of life. So you can take this symbolically to mean it's simply poetic speculation, or that this was an actual sharing of scientific information between scribes, poets, scholars, astronomers in China and the Near East. We do know from recent research in Egypt that there were Chinese artifacts found in the earliest location of Cairo. Various porcelain and stoneware was found that was obviously imported from China at a very early date, at Fusat.
Mm-hmm.
So there's definitely a connection between East and the Near East at a very early stage of human development, and I'm suggesting that we're just beginning to scratch the top of the iceberg, so to speak, and realize there are vast archives of information that will come out that I feel will help rewrite history, that the human race was here at a much earlier period of time, working with mathematics, music, astronomy, and sacred architecture, and this will help reinterpret the whole evolution and life track.
What is the significance, and this question for either of you, of the fact that there was connection based on the speculation as a result of the analysis of this bone and what was written on it, that there was connection between the Far East, China, and Egypt? I mean, if so, what does that mean? What is the import of it?
Well, it goes back a long ways, because many people, even at the time of Jesus, think that he had no connection with the Far East. There would be no reason that he would ever be able to travel there. And if you go back to the Scroll of Esther, which is right in everyone's Bible, which is 500 B.C., not quite as old as the elephant scapula bone, but still significantly older than the time of Christ, you'll find that Esther was connected with this king, Ahasuerus, who was ruling from India to Ethiopia. He had jurisdictional districts covering that large of a distance. So
mm-hmm.
it means that there could have been a vast amount of information shared on a continual level from people, you know, way back even, we'll say, and I'm stretching it a little bit, but to the King of Solomon. There's no reason why to think these people were not in some sort of correspondence. I think we lost that knowledge at the time of the Dark Ages. We started going into these little, small little regional areas, and we didn't realize that there was this vast communication, this vast sharing. And so when you look at pyramids in China and you also look at pyramids in Egypt, you can see that there was this connection, and maybe even going back beyond what we would consider even 4,000 years, because we would also date the Great Pyramid as being far further back than just the 4,000 years.
So what Desiree is saying, if I can encapsulate, is that there was a navigation society that connected the energy points of the planet that obviously shared certain information that would suggest that astronomers, mathematicians, pyramid builders, architects did share some areas of information, that this was not localized only in the Middle East or the Far East, or for that matter
mm-hmm.
in the New World, in South America. That we have now evidence, and some of this was presented in 2001 in Vienna, Austria, at a very special conference dealing with anthropological anomalies by Klaus Dohna, who invited leading experts from all over the world to look at more than 500 artifacts coming from different parts of the world, showing a much earlier strata of history that shouldn't really be there, but is there.
As far as, for example, the China and Egypt, what is there a known trade route between those two areas?
Interesting enough, the known route was, of course, even going back beyond the Silk Road, from through this area called the Taklamakan Basin and some of those regions. And if you go back to real history and legends and mythologies, they'll even tell you that there was probably a civilization back in the Taklamakan area, which is just north of Tibet and now is vast desert.
Mm-hmm.
But this area could have been literally one of the seeds of civilization, probably going back maybe as far as 36,000 years. We have pictures in the Keys of Enoch that show cities on tops of mountains. Right now you go there and there's nothing but desert, but they have discovered some ancient civilizations in that area. And one of the things they did find, not quite as old as what we're talking about right now, but they found even red-haired mummies in this area of China.
Of China. I remember reading about that when they at least released that information, and everybody was going, oh, how could that be?
Well, they don't go quite as far old, but they are as old as the Egyptian mummy. So that shows that there is this at least connection. And another thing, going even further to Japan, you find also pyramids in Japan. Some of these things are large mounds. A lot of the structures in the Far East are earth mounds instead of the bricks. And so people are always looking for these stone, huge stone monuments. But the earth mounds are just as significant. And if you had them, you might as well build them. You know, it's easier than having someone, you know, do different changes of moving stones up the ramps if they're going to do it that way. Or if you look at Ed Lee Scallon in Coral Castle, perhaps it was through some sort of levitation technique.
Now, what was the purpose of all these pyramids, though? I mean, did all of these civilizations with their different approaches to the pyramids, did they all have the same purpose in building them?
Well, it's hard to back engineer and reconstruct what it went in the minds of the various architects of each region.
Mm-hmm.
It's clear that from what we've been able to confirm through our musical acoustical tests, that these structures were also seen as vibratory sacred places where priests, social thinkers, members of each of the corresponding societies could come to make contact with the stars and with the divinities that were called upon. It is clear also that these structures were very carefully built, to use the terminology of Mircea Eliade, one of the great anthropologists. The sacred space was enclosed within walls, interiored in such a way as to create, as it were, a ladder to the heavens. And so the whole process of the man-god partnership or human deification was in part, as many anthropologists think at this time, behind the schema to build these massive structures throughout the world.
One of the interesting things, of course, in the Mayan culture is that you have pyramids within pyramids. You have the older pyramids on the inside, and they kept building on top. So it's very difficult to start dating some of these structures. But what was also interesting in our work in Egypt, which you, Barbara, mentioned, is that we worked with the Osiris tomb. Now, that's 100 feet, which is 30 meters, 100 feet underneath the Giza Plateau. That's an awful long ways to go just to bury somebody. I mean, you wonder why they had these really deep tombs. There must have been something going on that allowed them to consider these deep structures underneath the ground. I mean, we bury people 6 feet down. I mean, why do you have to go 100 feet? It's a tremendous structure that's underneath the Giza Plateau, and our research with remote sensing radar showed also that there's more under the sands of Egypt than you have above the ground. So there's a whole complex, literally, of temples and areas of energy, resonance, and vibration that's there, and also of tombs.
Well, now, you mentioned putting them under the ground. Isn't it also possible that when they were built, they were on the surface, and that over the years, the sands have covered them, and then more things were built, and then the sands covered that, and more things were built, so they wind up being 100 feet down, but maybe they were sea level before?
I have a picture of Desiree's father in Cairo, 1923, on top of a camel with colleagues from the University of Vienna.
Mm-hmm.
And all you see is the head of the Sphinx. The body is completely covered by sand.
Right.
Clearly, over the long periods of history, the sands of time have covered up much of these historic artifacts and megalithic centers. But in point of fact, we're now at a time of history where we have these remarkable tools that can precisely go down under dry sand, some 6 to 9 meters, and help us detail things that normally would have taken generations of experts and proper timing to go into these underground sanctuaries. And I believe we're at a stage of uncovering in Egypt and the Far East a much earlier track record of the human race that could conceivably help us link up the many disciplines.
Go ahead.
There's one of the things we did find, which we don't talk about too often, but that is we found a stone that actually has gamma ray radiation, which means that we've personally believed that they had certain types of technologies that they used, and perhaps there was some reason for that in terms of having these underground structures that it's a type of almost nuclear type of technology that maybe they were using some of these tombs, some of these areas to literally preserve some of this technology.
We're talking about in Egypt in 1977 where we have an artifact that is very interesting because it's a polished piece of glass that under special lighting throws off a blue light. And under private measurement by some of my colleagues who work with the government, it showed very strong gamma ray radiation level. So the question is, how did the Egyptians come up with these type of artifacts? Why do they reflect gamma ray radiation? Is this possibly connected with the biblical teachings that fire and brimstone fell from the sky during the time depicted as Sodom and Gomorrah, and perhaps this was brought and stored in an underground sanctuary in Egypt as an example of a much earlier period of history that came to a sudden close, maybe due to some man-made nemesis or some type of divine nemesis? Again, these are very provocative questions, and this is why we try to bring together dialogue in the areas of geology, archaeology, anthropology, linguistics, musicology, in the space sciences, because literally one discipline cannot encompass the vastness of what is appearing on the world scene right now. We are seeing an avalanche of information suddenly open up with the vast findings of Coptic documents in Egypt, these earlier artifacts that we are speaking about in Central Asia. More recent findings in Egypt suggest a much more advanced level of intelligence that was there in design of these huge monuments. And finally, what does all of this mean in terms of where we go from here in terms of the human track of evolution?
I was curious, you mentioned the music and the resonance before. I know of the Rosetta Stone, and I know of using that as the key to translating what hieroglyphics says. I don't know that we ever found anything like that for the Mayan civilization. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't believe we have. Have we ever found music, written music in any of these ancient civilizations that we could actually play on an instrument today so that we would know what kind of music they played? Now that I think of it, I don't ever remember hearing anything about that.
Well, we've had tests in Egypt from Paul Horn to Wendy Luck, famous instrumentalists, but more to the point, In Guatemala, we carried out some musical experiments back in the early 1980s with the Balk Research Foundation of Charlotte, North Carolina. And Desiree, you can take it from there.
Well, I was going to say, Nature magazine had these ancient flutes that were found in China. And these are some of the oldest instruments that have ever been discovered. And they were made by bone and structures like that. We have pictures on the walls of people playing instruments, both in Egypt and also in the Mayan culture, certain types of sounds and conch shells and different relationships. The problem is we don't know the scale anymore. The scale has completely changed. What we use today is, I believe it's called the tempered scale, has totally been changed. So we don't know the vibrations. Even the Psalms in the Bible were supposedly originally sung, and they were sung over the body of the dead. Now, this is very similar to what took place in the Egyptian Book of the Dead. These were hymns that were sung to help the soul ascend. So it's almost a similar thing. This is our book, The Pistosophia, which we talked about the last time Dr. Jack and I were on with George, talks about the connection between what the Hebrews are talking about and what the Egyptians actually had. The same thing of this resurrection, this power, but we don't know those frequencies. We don't know those vibrations. The Academy for Future Science has actually tried to come up with some of the sound frequencies, and there's a certain tone called the devil's chord, which when you do the resonance in the Great Pyramid in the King's Chamber, you actually get some of those frequency notes. Now, it's called the devil's chord because it's odd notes that are known to, when you put them together, have a certain strange kind of eerie frequency. But strange enough, that's one of the resonant harmonics that you get in the Great Pyramid.
And we
actually have a music album, CD available called The Living Capstone. We use the voice gifts of Paul Burns, who's the male vocalist, to actually sound out the ancient Hebrew, Aramaic, Egyptian word patterns with the music vibrations being captured. And it's quite a remarkable experience for everyone who has heard this. They will feel a tremendous energy rush through the system. So obviously, there was something in the nature of the grand architects in the building of these ancient monuments. They understood mathematics and music. They understood energies that could be brought together or synergized with certain individuals, and these were the holders of the knowledge of why these civilizations built their structures pointed towards certain constellations, suggesting that we are consciously preparing ourselves ultimately to go back and to make contact with our creators.
Do you think that they were, if we go back as far as Egypt and perhaps that civilization is even older than we think it is, and you said that earlier, and I know there's a lot of speculation about that, did they know that perhaps they came from somewhere else? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, they definitely say that Orion is part of their key home vibration. Orion connected with Osiris, Isis connected with Sirius. These are the star constellations that they recognize as being part of the power behind the whole civilization. Orion, or Osiris, I should say, came and brought the knowledge, brought the wisdom to the Egyptians for all these structures, for all the mathematics. And you have the whole scenario, of course. Thoth is another god connected mm-hmm. with Enoch, who brought all the wisdom. And in fact, he has this book called the Book of Thoth, which is not the same one from Aleister Crowley. He was just trying to copy the vibration.
Right.
That was able to also bring the knowledge of the stars, bring the knowledge of the higher heavens, what they were all about. So all that knowledge was there. Unfortunately, all of that knowledge has been lost.
We will continue.
Have good science because we
hold on. Save the thought. We're at the top of the hour. We will be back. I'm Barbara Simpson on Coast to Coast AM. Barbara Simpson here, and we're talking with Dr. J.J. Hertak and Desiree Hertak. I was asking a question of them before the end of the last hour about ancient music, and we know that the ancients, of course, had instruments. You are getting the resonance from these structures, Dr. Hertak, but actually in any of the texts that we found, or the scrolls, or any carvings, we've never found anything that could be identified, I guess would be the right word, as music scores, right?
That's right, Barbara. What we've discovered in today's equal tempered tuning scale, the musical pitches that we've been able to identify specific harmonics
mm-hmm.
do line up in various pyramids showing F sharp to A sharp, whether it's in China at Xi'an, whether it's in Mexico in the Yucatan, whether it's in Egypt along the Nile. It's very interesting to see specific musical frequencies, 87.3 cycles per second F sharp, 174.6 cycles per second F sharp, 369.8 cycles per second F sharp. These measurements are done by some of the most sophisticated computers and sound instruments in the world. And what we're saying here is we see here, besides the equal temperament and the chromatic scale, musical values that are very, very sophisticated that were known to the ancients, suggesting that there may have been a higher evolutionary contact experience that would draw together so many of these diverse cultures sharing a common musical scale. One can make an argument, of course, this comes through turning on the light bulb of the chamber of the inner mind and saying, wow, there is something there to the nature of vibrations. All life is vibrations. Let's find out just mm-hmm. what makes up, as it were, the key resonance pattern that opens the mind to higher awareness. But there's another side to all of this. Desiree can capsulize.
Well, one of the things we wanted to say about the Great Pyramid itself is, in addition, we found that these star shafts are also sound shafts, almost like a Coke bottle would have a certain frequency. And above the King's Chamber, which is where a lot of our tests were done, is five different cavities. And those five different cavities seem to also make a certain type of resonance from what we've been able to detect with our sensitive sound equipment. So it is a type of bell or sound resonance chamber as a significant part of why the pyramids are like that. But I would also say the whole concept of going into the stars, going out to Orion, is also important. And we have to look at what is Orion, what kind of vibration, what kind of people, what kind of intelligence probably had made that connection to this planetary system. And so if you want to move a little bit more into the higher worlds to say these were very positive intelligences that came here that wanted to teach the planet. We know that throughout the Middle East there was these theories about how there was flying discs that would come down and people would get out and teach and talk and give the knowledge of how to do certain type of horticulture, agriculture, taking care of animals, teaching herbs. This is all part of the legends that go back, and we think that these are more than legends. These are actual realities.
And isn't it true that those legends are repeated in different cultures around the world? So it's not only Egypt that you have similar things happening. And, of course, the question is, how did it happen and why?
Actually, this is a very profound question, and this is basically why I was motivated as a young student of ancient literature and text, and even looking at our Bible, particularly Genesis chapter 49, where it speaks of the blessings given to the sons of Jacob, and one is mentioned as having, as it were, the blessing of the lion, which some interpreters in the Hermetic tradition take to be a symbol of the Sphinx. Mm-hmm. Why this should appear in the Bible, and why there should be so many emphasis sections placed upon Lamentations and the whole process of the Christ child going to Egypt. What does this really mean in the overall scheme of things? And what I'm suggesting in my other work is that the ancients were contacted by higher evolutionary intelligence, were given information which was stored in stone, and that the very shape of these stone monuments themselves gives a musical notation. Let me illustrate this. In 1981, Desiree and I were in Tikal, Guatemala, on Temple Number 2, as it is called, and as we began to use certain mantrams, the pyramids began to oscillate. And Tikal means, in the ancient language of that region, city of sound, city of vibration. We were able to actually capture these sounds on a tape recorder and bring them to Europe, and musicologists recognized there were paraphysical features in the sounds. They were quite interesting overtones, other voices were picked up, and this is somewhat shocking, I know, to the radio audience, but privately they felt that there was a connection between music and these ancient structures on a very profound level that had been lost throughout history.
Mm-hmm.
The story is picked up by Gerald Hawkins, who did the study of Stonehenge in England with the IBM computers back in the 60s, who later went on to analyze some of the megalithic centers in England and suggest in his research that there are also musical components to some of these structures, why they are aligned and why they function both as astronomic guides to the human evolution as well as a type of musical communication with the Godhead. So we're seeing the missing pieces being filled in from various parts of the world, suggesting we're much closer to a quantum leap in putting all of the pieces together.
Well, what if you put the pieces together, what would we know? Because if it's connecting, as you said, to the Godhead, what does that mean?
It means that all of the megalithic centers that we have looked at, and we're certainly far from looking at all of the major ones, but the most significant ones that we've looked at seem to spell a musical pattern, and it could very well be a type of musical signature that connects with the oscillations of a greater language system, or possibly some type of cosmic pulse that somehow provides a handshake or a type of consciousness awareness of our cosmic counterparts.
So we're saying it's not just the individual. In a sense, you can take it from the very basic level that when the person is there inside the pyramid and he's using certain key vibrations, key sounds, he's able to raise his consciousness to be back into a type of connection with these higher intelligences that exist in space. But what we're also saying is that these pyramids and sacred areas are built in certain places around the planet so that when the right connections are made, there's also this resonance oscillator that happens throughout the planet that's able to really activate a certain type of consciousness to raise on the planetary system.
So to connect the pieces, there's a type of musical pattern
mm-hmm.
throughout the world that the ancients knew about, that we've lost in the movements of thought of Western intellectual history. And now we're coming to an exciting period of time where we're pushing the frontiers in space, pushing the envelope in consciousness in physics, and we're suddenly realizing that there are, as it were, patterns that link up. And one of the interesting findings that was made in recent times in England with the Chandra satellite system was from that constellation called Perseus at a distance of 260 million light years, there is a sound structure being picked up 57 octaves below middle C in the region of B-flat A-sharp. It's interesting that that sound structure should be picked up by sophisticated British scientists and astronomers. What is this saying? It's saying that we are just beginning to put together a cosmic syntax of contact, and this goes back to my experiences in the early 70s, where I had a higher consciousness experience, and I saw how certain situations in the Bible, in the book of Genesis, Exodus, and Numbers, were actual musical, mathematical patterns of places throughout the world, and this led us on our quest to confirm the fact that the 12 tribes of Israel represent symbolically 12 different vibratory points of the world population that carry a higher knowledge and a higher wisdom.
And one of these areas is right in Taiwan, the area connected with Yonaguni. And as you know, Yonaguni is to the east of Taiwan, but there's also structures underneath the water that's been found to the west of Taiwan. And this whole region is literally a honeycomb with these ancient temples and structures.
For the sake of those who may not know, what is the Yonaguni?
Yonaguni is a series. Actually, many people just think it's one place called the castle, which is submerged.
Mm-hmm.
But there's actually about 8 structures that are submerged in that region. Dr. Jack spent some time there in Okinawa studying.
It's a small island 50 kilometers east of Taiwan.
Mm-hmm.
And through Japanese, Australian, and other researchers that we work with, we've been able to explore in 8 different locations of these so-called submerged platform structures that are very peculiar and unique and have on the tops of some of them a veneer that is in the shape of a turtle shell, which goes back to Oriental mythology that the turtle shell represents the foundation of life and evolution on this planet. But it's interesting that in a submerged environment in the Pacific, we have evidence of what could be called origins of ancient civilization.
It's also interesting that the turtle was significant for the Native Americans as well. This entire planet was known as Turtle Island. So the fact that the turtle just by itself, forget about the pyramids, you can look at the turtle, is significant mm-hmm. in the Indian culture, in the Japanese culture, and also in the Native American culture.
As far as where these are found, how deep are they, and in whose territorial waters are they?
In Taiwanese waters are more recent evidences found, and of course the Yonaguni, Ryukyu Island areas are in the southernmost part of the Japanese territorial possessions. So they're technically in Japanese waters, but researchers have had the opportunity to work, as it were, on an international basis, and several documentaries have been brought out by the Japanese as well as one American research team in recent time, shown on Fox television a few years ago, mm-hmm. showing that this is just the beginning of putting together the early proto history of our planet that goes back at least to the end of the last ice age.
And it's not very deep. They're only about 15 to about 75 feet, depending on, you know, the tops of the structures versus the bottom of the structure.
How could they possibly have survived with just shipping in those waters? I would think, especially, you know, Japan being an island nation, they've, over the centuries, certainly, they've had thousands of ships and boats going through there. It's almost a miracle that they would have survived if they're as shallow as 15 to 20 feet in some places.
Again, the movement, the ocean dynamics is very, very strong, and this particular area where the Yonaguni site was mm-hmm. is off on the side of many of the shipping routes. So this is one of the anomalies of why it took so long for underwater divers to find and locate and do the proper remote sensing research. But in short, what we're saying is there are places now that we can get to because we have better underwater instrumentation. We have many submarines equipped with the right sonar, with the right instrumentation, so we can explore regions that were, for all intents and purposes, off limit until the present generation.
And I do want to qualify, they go down as deep as 75 feet as well, so they're quite
sure.
deep in some of the areas. And, of course, there's actually one structure that's just a huge, long wall, and it's so huge and so long, but it's hard to photograph this because it's in an area that is just kind of dark, and you can't get lights down there and structures that will be able to photograph it. But there's different places all around. In fact, as Dr. Jack mentioned, on the west side of Taiwan, there's a whole other wall structure. So the whole area from there all the way down, we believe, to the Philippines, to various other islands, was all part of a landmass that was above ground before the last ice age. And with the ice age, we know that the water levels came up about 300 feet, and mm-hmm. so a lot was sunken.
Have there been any age testing on pieces of these structures to get some idea of what we're talking about in terms of how old they are?
Well, this is a big debate that's underway. The Japanese claim to have tools that have been found in some of these locations. American geologists are skeptical. This would cause, as it were, considerable rewriting of specific history. Others are looking at the possibility that that the transmigration of peoples across the Pacific took place from this area, which is of interesting, showing, as it were, connections with the myths and legends of the survivors
mm-hmm.
who
right.
came to Peru and Ecuador, who had features in the way that they reconstructed their platforms at high elevations near Cusco and other locations, similar to what we found with the three-step model under the waters of Yonaguni in Taiwan. So this, again, is a piece of geology and archaeology that doesn't fit. It suggests that we are much older in our evolutionary track. It suggests correspondence with a navigational society that may have connected several places in the South Pacific. It suggests, through the other illustrations we have given, that there was a mapping of communication and cultural symbiosis between the Far East and the Near East at a much earlier period of history, and that may have clues to the origins of life. Now, the $64 million question is, of course, how does this play into the footprints and the evidences of a cosmic signature, the fact that they may, that is to say, the Japanese and Chinese documents may be correct in saying that they are representing the cosmic counterparts of the human race.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a higher connection? This is what we want to examine carefully. And to that end, we've been able to look at documentation, more recent, of course, by various investigators, various governments, stating that spacecraft, unidentifiable spacecraft, has appeared over some of these megalithic centers.
Like, why is Mexico one of the major places where extraterrestrials and spacecraft have been seen? This is a real question. It's one of the largest places of pyramids, and it also talks about different cycles. We're already in the fifth age of the sun cycles because of cataclysms.
Or why the spacecraft have been seen and photographed over the pyramids in Calamacuyu in Guatemala City back in the early 70s, why spacecraft have been seen over various parts of the Japanese islands in the South Pacific, more recently over China. All of these situations basically force us to go beyond one discipline into another, suggesting that anthropology must be expanded to look at the cosmic design of things, that we may have, in these locations, come across a technology or a terraforming process that is not of human origin, but rather off-planetary origin.
You know, if you were able to definitively prove the things that we're talking about here, it would absolutely and totally change the history, change all our history books, wouldn't it?
Well, again, this is what some would call pushing the envelope. Some would call simply too speculative to be taken seriously, which is why we are utilizing new tools and new processes and methodologies to look at the information from a higher perspective. You might call an a-perspective view, not looking at a given philosophy or theology, but looking at the whole planetary
right.
picture.
But we think it's only a matter of time till this is all known and acknowledged. It's just the pioneering phase right now that we're all going through.
As pioneers traditionally have not been respected by mainstream, do you find it hard to convince people of what you're doing?
Well, we're fortunate,
or the value.
I think, to work with people who are in the field, and they also have the same feelings. We worked with John Anthony West back when he was doing the research with the Sphinx and showing the water levels were up there with Robert Schock. So all these people that we work with all know about it. It's everyone else that we're trying to bring along and convince. But the evidence, even maybe we'll talk in the next half hour about this place in South America called Pedra Ferrada, which goes back to 50,000 years in South America.
We will absolutely do that. We're talking with J.J. Hertak, Ph.D., and Desiree Hertak, and the planet we live on. We think we know so much, don't we? Well, maybe people in the past knew more than we did, and that's what we're trying to find out. And we'll be taking your calls a little later on, as well as we continue right here on Coast to Coast AM. I'm Barbara Simpson. We're talking with J.J. Hertak, Ph.D., and Desiree Hertak. Dr. Hertak, you mentioned earlier, I think you said it was back in 1981 when you were in Tikal and you were in Temple 2, and that the pyramids started to oscillate.
That's right, Barbara. I was on the top section of the pyramid. Dr. Belk and Desiree were at the bottom with other researchers recording the music patterns, the mantric patterns that I began to sing and to use. They made a recording and tremendous light flashes took place. We later found out from the park authorities that at that time a group of guerrillas, terrorists, had surrounded that archaeological zone, and when they saw the light come down on top of these pyramids, they were afraid, and they left the park area.
Mm-hmm.
That's aside to the actual recordings, which we then brought to Europe, and very well-known musicologists, one, Sela Vedaci, analyzed these signals, and he said, clearly there is a higher voice there with the music overtones.
Because what was happening is that he was singing in a male voice. I was the only woman. I was not singing, because I don't usually do that at those places. I don't like my voice. And this high-frequency, almost female voice started being recorded, and you could hear it all over the whole temple area. It just resonated. So we don't know if that was some sort of paraphysical thing that was happening or just a real strange feedback from his own lower voice of a male. So this is the type of energy feedback we were getting from this particular temple, which is called the Area of Music. And, of course, it's the area that also talks about certain mathematics, like 144,000. So there's a unique tie-in to this sacred area of the world.
So what we're saying is that the pyramids themselves became musical notes, and the pyramids were arranged like an orchestra pit. So there's, as it were, to answer your earlier question about musical scores or musical notation, we believe the stones will speak, and when Jesus in the Gospels speak of stones speaking, we believe that is a metaphor for the fact that there are certain resonance points on the planet that will resonate if one uses the names of God or the names of celestial angelic forms, which we were doing at that particular moment, 1981.
Just out of curiosity, and this is something really off the wall, but you sort of planted a seed as we've been talking tonight. If there are pyramids around the world, and if they are there for the reasons you're talking about, with this oscillation and the resonance and the musical notes, etc., what would happen if they all started vibrating and it spread from one to the other, that eventually they were all vibrating? What would that do to the Earth, the planet itself?
I believe the energy of human consciousness would dramatically change. What we're seeing here in the world of our generation of conflict is that the psychic energy is out of balance. The paraphysical energy is out of balance. The spiritual energy is out of balance. And we can see this in so many ways, even in the Psalms of King David. With the right notation, with the right alleluias, with the right songs of prayer and praise to the ends of the earth, certain nodal points will reflect this higher harmonic, and the higher or heavenly choir then, so to speak, manifest a healing power or resonating power to bring humanity into balance. So to answer your question, we are looking at the possibility that some of these temples, not all of them, some of them have very specific music cues that are connected with consciousness physics and a type of cross-cultural or pluralistic vision of a new planetary process.
Were the originally we were told that the pyramids were the tombs of the kings, and now scientists are saying, no, that's not the case, and, you know, what the other purposes might have been, some of the things we're talking about. Some of the pyramids down in Central and South America were used for sacrificial religious purposes, or at least for sacrificial purposes. How do you reconcile the two uses, or the two presumed uses of these structures against what you're learning?
Yeah, from what we found, that the sacrificial part actually came much later. The original builders on a lot of even the early Mayans, of course, it came from the Olmec civilization and then to the Mayan culture, did not do the initial sacrifice. In fact, if you look at the whole game plan in the Mayan with the ball courts and with the different alignments of the stars, it was literally showing the course of life. And you actually had the game that you played. You had the place of baptism. You always had a well place for the water. You had unique, alignments with the stars and the heavens. So it was a much different cosmology than what eventually happened. It kind of degraded. And it's interesting because there's a Coptic scripture called Asclepius that even talks about Egypt. It says the place of the gods, and the gods will leave, and they're prophesying about the future, and the place that was the temples of the gods will become only the tombs. And so it's that whole
The Coptic language is the schoolhouse of the god, small g. And it's interesting that the Coptic Christians included that within their scripture, suggesting at one time Egypt was blessed before it fell under the spell of mischief and the misuse of divine energy. We find that also in the New Old Testament with Joseph and Jacob in Egypt and the wondrous teaching that they personify in that particular period of time. So what we're saying here is, you know, we can look at this theoretically, abstractly, but I'm asking the radio audience to go to our websites, keysofenoch.org or futurescience.org, and get a copy of the actual music that we use for the experiments. One album is called Living Capstone. There are various other albums that we could suggest that you can order as you call up the websites. Look at some of the scientific research there. Also keep in mind another colleague's research, Dr. Lambert Dolphin, ldolphin.org, is a very outstanding source to go to. He worked at Stanford Research Institute, did a lot of interesting studies showing certain correlations that are too complex to go into on the program tonight.
Sure.
But we have people even in the Russian Academy of Science and Chinese Academy of Science, such as Dr. Shimon Schnoll, leading biologist, mathematician, Kozma Sheyev, others, who've looked at this from their folk history and culture orientation and said, yes, there's something to this puzzle. There is definitely a higher sound structure, a higher syntax that links the various cultures together in a much earlier period of time.
And Barbara, what we really think, and I think we have to go back to the fact that this is the fifth age of the sun, according to the Mayan culture, that there's been several ages. And at the very beginning, we call it the alpha point of each cycle, there's a lot of information given to the planet, given to the people who are living, you know, you're given a good start, and then they let it go for something like 5,000, 6,000 years, depending on which culture you're looking at, maybe 5,125 for the Mayans. And at the end of the cycle, they come back and they start saying, well, you know, what did you do? And that's the omega point. And then that actually coincides usually with other changes going on planetary-wise, whether you look at the solar flares, whether you're looking at different changes going on throughout the planet, maybe the change of the magnetic fields. And at that point, you know, you're given a new cycle to start again because changes are just, you know, too great for humanity to stay on the planet for that point of time.
Are the implications of that we're facing, I don't want to say an apocalypse, but sort of an end to it all?
Well, we think there's several alpha and omega
cycles. This would be called the myth of the eternal return in the language of anthropologists, where the creators, the architects, come back to the scene of the experiment. And again, this gets us into the next chapter of our research, which is working behind the scenes with those on very high levels of government and research work that have actual documentation showing pictures, showing film clips, even certain recordings of sounds coming from unidentified technology that has appeared over these historic megalithic points.
What do you mean?
What do I mean? I mean that there is a correspondence now taking place between these points of evolution and what appears to be the return of the cosmic cultures or members from the cosmic cultures who are tuning in to these particular parts of the human condition and identifying themselves over the points of evolution, such as Stonehenge, for example, in the United Kingdom.
If we have not deciphered how all of that works, though, do they think they're getting through to us, or are they just trying and we haven't quite made the connection
yet?
Well,
we think it's very interesting that all these crop circles, at least the majority of them, are happening right around Stonehenge and Avery. In that one particular area, they're trying to, I think, in many ways communicate with us through certain types of sacred geometry and sacred vibration, which actually Gerald Hawkins has considered may be a musical code as well.
Now, Gerald Hawkins is just not an ordinary guy. He's the guy who did the most significant research, as I mentioned before, but also was, before he passed away recently, was a spokesman for the British government on several areas of very sensitive information. We're looking at deciphering or demythologizing these symbols according to what appears to be manifestations of energy and sound coming from unidentified spacecraft. Some would call them vehicle transports from the other worlds or the other dimensions of evolutionary intelligence that seems to be there on the scene, and we can't figure out why they should be there. So this is, again, the whole puzzle of why I think many of the governments have kept quiet on this question. Indeed, are we seeing a return of the, shall we say, the original architects to the scene of the experiment? Do those who put the documents in the earth know where they were? Are they somehow connected with those coming from the higher worlds or the other multi-level worlds that are returning to the human experiments to update, as it were, a very bad track record?
You know, I think, too, the usual comeback that you get from people when you're talking about, you know, whether or not we've been visited by ETs, extraterrestrial beings, whatever they might be, and the question always is, well, you know, why do these ships or these abductions always happen in remote places? You know, if they want to contact, why don't they land on the lawn of the White House kind of thing? And I guess my question in regard to what we're talking about this morning is, if these beings, if these spirits, if whatever they are, if they're so smart, why can't they contact us in a way we can understand? Why are they forcing us, if you will, to try to figure out what their message is through these other means that we don't even know how they work?
Well, first of all, we feel that there are different levels of intelligence watching us. And some are very basic and do play around with us, like the abduction experiences. Some are much higher. Some of them don't even need spaceships. They actually can travel mentally and materialize where and when they want to. But it's interesting, this watching us and not, because I like to think of us almost like we're in a birdcage. You know, we've been placed in this birdcage for a while, and occasionally the cat, you know, can get his claw in and have some problems. But usually they're just, you know, standing around watching. And it's interesting, this recent UFO sighting in Mexico. If you, it wasn't so popular on the news here. It was, we were in Europe at the time and they played it up more. And of course in Mexico they showed about 10, 15 minutes of film. This is the Campeche UFO, sighting that was done by three, Air Force pilots. And of course the whole government got involved in this.
And actually two military officers lost their position as a result of this because information wasn't kept quiet.
But what was really interesting is that it was not seen. They could not see it physically. Even though they were flying, they could not see it physically.
It was seen only through infrared.
And also on radar. So you had, they were right there. They were not far away. They were only flying at about 10,500 feet above the ground. And they could only see it by their radar and by this technique that they were using, which Dr. Jack mentioned, which is that flying light infrared system that they use. And they picked it up. These 11 objects, can you imagine 11? That's not a small number flying around.
No, it's not.
And, you know, they picked it up by this heat-sinking type of technology that they use for reconnaissance to look for drug runners running around, and they traced it for 15 minutes on film. In fact, I think the film actually even goes a little bit longer, but the main part was 15 minutes. So, you know, they're there. They're watching. They have ways of not being seen, not being known, because they want to know what we're going
to
do.
And many of them are negative, which is why our government has had to be very, very careful in the past. to screen the information and why there is, as it were, another take to all of this information that does not get into the mainstream of academia and serious research. And so that has to be changed. We have to be aware now that we're moving into a very violent period of human history, and there are, to be sure, both positive and negative forces in outer space. Which do we turn to? Do our prayers work? Do our prayers go to the lower ETs? Are our prayers answered by, as the prophets of old have said, the Most High God? And we have found in the use of the higher language in the pyramids and temples throughout the world, there are higher responses of light, subliminal communication, some would call it, consciousness, awareness, and love, that is unlike what goes in situations of human sacrifice, the whole abduction scenarios that Bud Hopkins and others have personified so well in recent times. It suggests that we have a lot of mischief around the corner.
Is God an ET? Is that what?
God is not an ET. God is beyond all of the flotsam and jetsam out there in outer space.
Mm-hmm.
And my work is to show that there is a much higher approach to this if we take seriously the musical portions of our sacred scriptures of the West and the traditional scriptures of the East and the indigenous people of the world that suggest that we must reach up higher to the peacemakers and those that represent the higher message of divine love and compassion for the planet. In the West, this has been done largely through the symbol of the Divine Father. In the East, it's the symbol of the Divine Mother.
Mm-hmm.
But we clearly think that there's higher levels of intelligence that are more like the angelic, even using vehicles that one would call the Merkaba, which are not physical vehicles. They're not nuts and bolts. And then you have other levels of intelligence, which are just about like us, you know, having the ups and downs with the emotions, with the intellect, with the rational mind, that are able to maybe work in, you know, fifth-dimensional space, travel through walls. That's not a big deal if we were another, you know, 1,000 years more advanced. So you have that type of technology, but then you have those that are even beyond that. And we feel, actually, that the local extraterrestrials are also going through some of the same challenges that we are. You know, you have genetic problems going on. You have other aspects of just being able to not manage their own technologies without destroying themselves and others to go along with that. So we look at a vast hierarchy of civilizations out there.
So this is a type of global awakening, a global assessment that requires us to have a higher analytical framework for putting all of these missing pieces together and to take a deep breath and realize that behind the scenes there's a lot of research that is going on suggesting that we're going to go into a massive acceleration of information as the prophet Daniel says in chapter 12, knowledge will increase. And humanity will be numbered with the stars. We believe that is part of the cosmic picture of anthropology, musicology that is now coming into play.
And the Coast to Coast show is one of those.
I think you're right in terms of bringing out the information. You mentioned what's going on this planet today, and clearly there is conflict almost all over to various degrees. So when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about the influence that that might have on our future and our relationship with these other beings. We'll also be opening our lines so you folks out there can have at it with some questions for our guests, Dr. J.J. Hertak, Desiree Hertak. The website, keysofenoch.org or futurescience.org. Also, they have a couple of books we'll talk about right here on Coast. I'm Barbara Simpson. Barbara Simpson here on Coast to Coast AM, and we're going to go to your calls in just a moment, but I want to ask our guest, Dr. Hertak, earlier on of our conversation this morning, you mentioned that the pyramids, you are supposing on the basis of your research that they were energy collectors. What was the source of the energy they were collecting, and what were they collecting the energy for?
Very good question. The work that's going on in several different locations suggests that the universe works through energy accumulators and that the pyramids were set in a certain position to be energy accumulators, that is to say, to draw in certain energies that then would be stored for reasons we're not sure, possibly for a source of power that could provide the light that would be necessary for these vast underground tunnel systems and rooms that we've partially explored in Egypt and in Central America. What we're looking at right now is a realization that there was very precise arrangements of rooms, and possibly the design of the pyramid in itself was to create a type of energy vortex through which energies in the universe could be drawn from. The Russians have recently put up a large pyramid structure outside of Moscow, some 144 feet high at an angle of 73 degrees, and they have found that since they put this pyramid up, the energies of Moscow have changed. People seem to be a little more positive. They're conducting energy experiments right now. So to answer your question, of course, we may have to wait a few years, but there's a large body of evidence to suggest that some sort of light source was drawn, some source of energy was activated, and in so many words, this energy was used and collected and fed into the substructures in various locations.
It is, you know, there are people who wear pyramid hats, and they say that, you know, being under the pyramid does something for them in terms of their spirit. I mean, if that's the case, and it really does do something like that, I mean, if everybody put a little tiny pyramid form on the roof of their house, wouldn't that be a positive thing?
Well, I'm saying this not to be fallacious. You know, there's a point at which you have to look at where all of this fits in with the reality game of looking at alternative energy sources and making use of a much wider spectrum of what perhaps was there to serve a particular society at a particular period of history.
Mm-hmm.
We are looking into the future. We're looking at hydrogen energy. We're looking at the use of fuel cells by 2017. They will be providing 30% of the energy, according to some of the experts. Fusion power will be here by 2025. There's so many positive scenarios for the future that we have to look at the pyramid as simply but one example of historic civilization going forward.
And it might have been some sort of energy technology, as Dr. Tech was also indicating, because there is water. One of the places we were at was connected with some of the water that just literally all underneath the Giza Plateau. So they had that water hydraulic energy.
Right.
We also, as we mentioned, saw some evidence of gamma ray radiation types of nuclear particles. So they also could have used these deep, deep tombs to protect some of that technology that they were working with. So there's different aspects of how the pyramid itself could have been used in addition to or, you know, in harmonics with your own body. In fact, your body, when you're in a type of meditation, say with your legs crossed and sitting
mm-hmm.
up straight, you actually become a type of tetrahedron. You are, yourself are a pyramid. So we don't think you have to go out and, you know, put pyramids over your heads. But there was research done, of course, in the 70s with Pat Flanagan where razor blades and meat, you know, would not, you know, corrupt so quickly if you put them
right
underneath pyramid energy. So there is something there.
I remember reading about that. And how difficult is it for mainstream science to accept the kind of research that you two do?
Well, one of the things I wanted to bring up, and I know you're going to go to callers in a minute, is that some of the questions have always been carbon dating. They always say, well, you know, what was your carbon-14 dating and things
right
like that. Well, carbon-14 has only gone back, can only reach back about 40,000 years, and it's strange enough that now we're starting to look at civilizations, evidence of man being in places that are more than 40,000 years, and so they've come up with a new technique called ABOX, which is acid-base wet oxidation, which will go take us to 56,000 years, and they're using that in the New World, so to speak, in South
mm-hmm.
America. There's a place in Brazil called Pedra Furada, which they're starting to date that mankind with rock art was there about 50,000 years ago. This is unheard
wow
of, absolutely unheard of. And if you look, of course, with Cuba, the possible findings off the coast of western Cuba that I know Linda Moulton Howe has talked about
yes
on your program, you're seeing that perhaps there was an earlier civilization in this part of the world. I think that's going to be our next real findings. We worked with J. Manson Valentine years ago in Florida, where he was the one that discovered and worked with Charles Berlitz on the Bimini Roads. I think there's a lot going on in this part of the world that we have yet to uncover.
I think all of this is so exciting. I wish we could get moving on it and start finding some of these things.
It Barbara, sounds like, to your earlier question, why don't they fly over the White House? This has occurred in 1952, and this is the basis of a lot of other documentation leading to Project Disclosure, which Stephen Greer has discussed with Art Bell, with tons and tons of information suggesting that there are other levels of intelligence already operating on the planet. And, of course, this is a bombshell in terms of what evidence do you have, and I can simply say I've gone right to the top of other government leaders, talked to those who work with President Sarney in Brazil, have actually seen military documents showing pictures of massive levels of spacecraft converged over military targets. I've seen this in Soviet documentation declassified. We are in for a big cosmic shift, and I don't mean to simply dance around the planet playfully by suggesting a few artifacts here and there, but some of these artifacts seem to be future artifacts. They seem to be out of the future, suggesting that they were placed there as tuning forks or devices to see how we as a human species would gather information, how we would evolve as a community at large, and if we reached a point that we were taking a technological slide towards self-destruction, they, the higher levels of cosmic intelligence, would intervene. The only problem with that argument is there's also the non-benign levels of intelligence, and this is where things get sticky as to who's out there, what do we believe, what credibility do we attach, for example, to the various speakers, including myself. And this is where really one has to have a lot of very good documentation to say, wait a minute, there is something to the story here, and all of this has to require a unity of the sciences, of the humanities, even of the theologies, to recognize that we're part of a much larger picture.
Yep, I think all of those would be affected, and quite frankly, all of those would be very threatened by this type of information, too. Let's do go to the phones. We have on the West of the Rockies line, Bill is calling. Bill, where are you located?
I'm calling from Tucson, Arizona.
Okay, go ahead, please.
I want to mention something that happened as a piece of information for your friends. I have a friend who was a sound engineer. Worked for a Miramax sound industry, sound engineering, and he was present during the production for Jean-Michel Jarre, who had a live concert on the eve. It was 1999, New Year's Eve. They had it live on the Great Plain of the Giza Plateau.
And
before one of his pieces of music, he played the tones of Do, Re, Mi, Fa, Sol, La, Ti, Do.
The scale.
And he reverberated, in other words, repeated each tone 9 times. When it reached the last tone, which was Do, Re, Mi, Fa, Sol, La, Ti, Do, the sound engineers picked up a wavelength frequency that permeated the entire plane during the concert that the audience was not able to hear, and yet when they played it back for recording days later, they said it was something like the realm of 72 on the scale. I don't know what that means, but my friend of mine who was there is a recording engineer, and he said that it was unbelievable. It was a frequency that occurred that no one heard, and they picked it up on the taping days after, and it was Do, Re, Mi, Fa, Sol, La.
But they should have it. They should still have it then, wouldn't they?
Yes, they do still have it. No one's ever been able to.
Well, if it's possible to get that, I have sound engineers in Los Angeles, some of the best who've worked with space research and music programs that could do a free analysis of this. We do know there are subtonal structures. There are semitones. There's a very, very elaborate scheme of music correspondence. I was able to record one series of notes that came off a spacecraft that came down in Argentina. I was there with the military intelligence in Argentina when it was recorded. A lot of this was popularized in Steven Spielberg's film, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, where at the end of this spectacular film you have, as it were, music being played to a mother craft that has suddenly come down in the midst of the cast of thousands. Everybody is flabbergasted that there's actual music cues that go back and forth, pre-verbal music cues, and with the process of this music orchestration, people's consciousness has changed, the ETs manifest themselves, and the story, of course, leaves us suspended in space as to a continuation, but Spielberg achieves, as it were, the mastery of getting us to be aware that there are musical patterns connected with some of this, which is why J. Allen Hynek himself did a cameo for that particular event, knowing very well that some of these contact stories do have musical signatures.
Amazing. Thank you very much for that call.
Thank you.
Let's go to Jerry is calling in the east of the Rockies line. Jerry, where are you located?
I'm in St. Paul, Minnesota.
Okay, go ahead.
Good show tonight. I wanted to ask if any of this has to do with possibly Anunnaki and the Nephilim, and also I had heard that the seed of Nephilim could have possibly got through the flood through Ham's wife, who may have been pregnant when she got on the boat. I know the seed probably made it through somehow. Like to know if they know anything about that.
Well, of course, this is the popular idea that some of the more recent writings have come out with, the Anunnaki story of those who were doing the mining on this planet. Zachariah Sitchin has brought forth the story and it made it popular. We're looking at something that is not so much in that direction, but rather in terms of the overall planetary story.
So we do think there's lots of different people, lots of different energies on the planet. So, you know, we don't want to identify with any particular one. We all think we have a greater potential to reach back into the stars, to be part of the, literally, the seed of Orion, if you want to take mythology, and to get off this planet, in a sense.
Nephilim being a word, of course, for the fallen angels. Some would call them the fallen scientists, those who did the false programming and thus created them of great might or wonder. And of course we know the whole story is repeated in one of the lesser known scriptures called the Book of Enoch, chapter 7, which is an anti-cloning text explaining what happens when things get out of hand very quickly.
Okay, let's go to the wild card line, and Chris is there. Good morning, Chris. Where are you?
Hi, this is Chris from Laguna Beach, California.
Okay, go ahead with a question for our guest.
Yeah, it was really coincidental. I was listening to Paul Horn analog album. I actually have the original album here, and I opened it up, and you were talking about frequencies, and he mentioned in here a frequency of 8438, which he hit on a G chord, and he said it was quite a vibrational frequency. Do you know anything about that particular frequency?
Well, I know that Paul Horn was there with two of my colleagues when he was doing the research, and some claim that when G was hit, they had, that is to say, inside the pyramid itself, they had a shift in consciousness, and one person claims that he recognized writing that appeared on the walls inside one of the chambers that normally would not be seen. So all I can say is it appears that Paul Horn has given us as it were, the first step of more intensive research that has to go on. One chord is not sufficient. We need literally a vast database of many sound engineers in many different locations, which we've been able to marshal in recent times.
And, of course, when we were there, we were able to bring, as Dr. Jack mentioned, our colleague Paul Thomas Burns there. We were all doing meditations and prayers. And basically, you're able to literally create this harmonic in the room where the sound frequency literally was bouncing into a spiral going up into the higher walls of the room. And it just did this standing wave frequency and this resonance that goes on top of it. And it's an amazing phenomena when you really get those resonances. I think this
one,
is what two
one of our sound engineers, actually, who's a special effects engineer, did all the music for Spielberg's Indiana Jones trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
So he was very open and very, very aware of what is simply happenstance cues and notes that are done, and that which is really the result of major tonal frequencies and vibratory levels that require tremendous acoustical properties.
But it's usually more than just one note, even though everyone's hitting this. I'm glad your first caller mentioned it's the whole scale, and then finally you get that resonant frequency that starts really taking off and making this higher vibration.
When you're in there in the pyramid with the several people and you're doing these tests with the various sounds, do all of you have this change in consciousness at the same time, or does it affect different people differently?
Well, I also want to qualify that some of the tests we did where there wasn't anyone in the room, where we were just recording on the oscilloscopes with a subwoofer in the chamber. So sometimes you don't want to always contaminate the chamber with people. But no, when you hear these frequencies, I mean, the resonant vibration literally puts you into these alpha states, into some of these different resonant patterns. So everyone hears that and feels that. I think people react to it in different ways.
May I ask one quick question, please?
Sure.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to butt in like that. You also mentioned a countdown time or the pyramids. I couldn't quite get the gist, but the pyramids are giving you a message of a coming time or a soon time.
Yes, what we're saying is there appears to be a cosmic countdown taking place.
Where
things are going to change rapidly in the next 20 years. Some would argue that this is going to happen in the next few years, and so we have to be very cautious.
In fact, the Keys of Enoch call the pyramids chronomonitors, and of course there's even pyramids that we found on Mars, and we feel that the reason why we're getting so close to understanding all this and coming out with this information, as you mentioned, Barbara, is because it is at that point that we really need to find out what it's all about because of the changes that are taking place.
We have to face future shock and culture shock with the wisdom of King Solomon and King David, who remind us of the music of the spheres of the heavenly choir, our cosmic counterparts that are positive, that will help us engineer a pathway through the flotsam and jetsam of world destruction that seems to be at our doorstep. And so we need to gear up and go into a higher musical frequency of love, compassion, and reach out to our counterparts throughout the world and throughout the universe with the realization of going forth.
Boy, that you know, it's a big order, asking humankind, as it is today on this planet, to benefit from the wisdom of Solomon. I hope we can pull it off. We'll see. We're talking with J.J. Hertak and Desiree Hertak. As I mentioned, and they mentioned, the book of knowledge, The Keys of Enoch, will be being re-released very shortly, and Art will be talking with them about that. And, of course, their website, keysofenoch.org and futurescience.org. Stay on the line. We'll get to your questions on Coast. We are going to go right to the phones. We have so many people on the line who want to talk to our guests, Dr. J.J. Hertak and Desiree Hertak. And so let's go first to the West of the Rockies line. Drew is there. Drew, where are you located?
I'm in Salt Lake City.
Okay. Go ahead with a question for our guests.
Yes. I was in Egypt in November with Sean David Morton's trip, the Harmonic Concordance trip. And we actually went in two of the pyramids. And some strange things happened. I had a couple of questions about the first pyramid we went in was the smallest, the Red Pyramid. And I've got a compass watch that actually broke. It's still broken. It doesn't work since I went in there. But the Great Pyramid is we spent the most time in. And the thing I noticed was if you felt the stones, they felt like they're resonating. It's like if you had struck a bell and touched the bell after you hit it, they'd actually resonate.
Wow.
The other thing is we took quite a few pictures, and you got these things that the best described as energy orbs. I mean, hundreds of them inside the King's Chamber. And I was wondering if your guest has had any experience with that.
Okay, two very good points. What about touching the stones, Desiree? Have you experienced that?
A lot of it is this red granite, and it is known for having certain types of crystalline properties within it. So I think there is a type of piezoelectric effect that is present, which could be all part of this energy process we're talking about. I also like the part of the question that asked about the orbs, and I think these orbs, which people are seeing mostly from digital cameras, but you get them from other ones as well, are very interesting. They seem to be coming in probably key areas more than other, you know, places. Like the guy probably took about 100 pictures, and you probably would find more orbs in the Great Pyramid than you would find in other places. Sometimes you blow up those orbs, they're like little mandalas. They're almost like little planetary spheres with grid points in them and around them. So it's a very fascinating thing. And people do have very unique experiences inside the Great Pyramid. I think this is one of the key reasons people want to look at all the different technologies and purposes for them. But the resonance, the experience that people have there really is making it a place of initiation.
And one looks at the musical notations, some of the tests there's a slope of the curve of the musical patterns that invariably is twice the slope of the preceding octave note, suggesting a golden mean spiral that is formed in some locations. And so there's very, very special harmonics that manifest themselves. And I have a picture on the cover of the CD and also the album Living Capstone showing the light intensity that manifested itself suddenly within a fraction of a second. Golden light literally appeared within the ascending chamber, and it's a very special picture that I've shown to researchers, music engineers throughout the world that our audience should be interested in.
Have you had, either of you had any problem with the authorities in Egypt to get permission to go in and do some of the things that, that you have done and still want to do in the pyramids?
Well, as you mentioned, we were really the ones that discovered the Osiris tomb with our colleagues. And at that time, we had remote sensing permission, and we had filming permission. We didn't have digging permission, so they didn't allow us to dig. They themselves dug it up and then showed it on television, Fox Television, a few years later. And we're fine with that. I mean, as long as they do bring things out, I think that's fine. It is their, you know, their department, their land, their country.
Sure.
But in terms of going back and doing sound techniques and testing, this is something that we can do and we do from time to time.
In other parts of the world, we generally work with government approval in order to get in because of the scope and the magnitude of what has to be tested. And it has to be tested at several meters below the surface of the earth. You have to be able to clear the area of human traffic for a period of time in order to do all of the other testing.
In fact, one of the places we did do testing is the Pyramid of Palenque, and there's the tomb down, that famous kind of lid on the tomb that looks like the ancient astronaut, the Vandenakens.
Right, exactly.
So we were down there, and this is the tomb of Pakal, and we were able to do sound testing there as well. So this all takes permission. You got to open, you know, get the guy with the key to open the door and things like that. So
this is why the keys of Enoch are musical keys. If you don't understand the music that go with each key, it doesn't make any sense because it's in a higher meta language of music, paraphysics.
That's a whole, you know, there really is a language of music, and of course, music is based on mathematics, and mathematics is a different kind of language. So, I mean,
right,
it really all fits together with that. That's amazing. We have to take another break, and we will come back with more calls with our guest, the Hertax, and I'm Barbara Simpson right here on Coast to Coast. We will go to the phones, as I promised. I'm Barbara Simpson. My guests are Desiree Hertak and Dr. J.J. Hertak. And coming up next is our caller. Let's see what line we're going to go to. The wild card line. Blair is there. Hi there. You're on the air. What? Where are you calling from?
From Chicago.
Chicago. Go ahead, Blair.
Okay, thank you. A couple of references. First of all, you mentioned briefly about the Russian pyramid. I understand that that's the Alata structure referenced by Igor Peredov, referred to now as the new harp. But also interesting is the blue pyramid that no one talks about, that the various electrical companies have been using for some time and hitting it with satellites. I have a question to ask, but I want to go through about 40 seconds only with you. You also mentioned, I think it was Isis, which should have been Ast, A-S-T. You mentioned Iasiclius. That should have been Imhotep instead of Hippocrates. What is interesting to me is that when you mention the Olmecs, and you're the first scientist I've heard to say that for some time, instead of just the Mayans, which you also find not only in South America near some of the ziggurats, but in Angkorvat and Thorvat. Also mentioned the two was, you mentioned Orion, but not Sirius. And it's stated again that one of the so-called air shafts, which I don't believe is what they are, referenced Sirius, the dog stars, which the Dogons talked about. Now, my question to you is this. How long will it take before racism, which is what's predominant on this planet, gets in the way of science, and hopefully as research scientists, cutting edge, and I don't call it paraphysics, I call it metaphysics, can get past that? How can you fight past that? Because if you talk to some of these people, like the Tuaregs or the Dogons, they will tell you about the visits there. They will tell you about the harmony and the songs that they chanted to get weather changes and all. Now we're doing it with the harmonics of harp, which is a negative aspect, creating deadly organ energy, which, of course, was talked about by Wilhelm Reich and others. So, again, hopefully you'll stay as current as you are and as honest as you are and go to that question for me, please.
All right, that's a very good comment, and I would simply say I respect very much the African side of the question and the heritage. I've worked with the Zulus extensively in southern Africa. I've spoken of the Dogon contributions. I know about the Sirius connection on a program of this magnitude with so many bases to cover, obviously there's going to be areas for further research and commentary. So I thank very much the caller, and I feel very good about what he says.
But let me also say that Dr. Tech mentioned our work in Africa. There is the great enclosure in Zimbabwe, which is also in alignment with various star constellations. This is a fantastic structure that's so old, people don't even know where it came from, where what it's about. There's also another area in Senegal, Gambia, which has it's a type of stone circle. In fact, the oldest stone circle that we've done research on is in southern Egypt, and it's called the area of Nafta, and they put this back to at least 6 to maybe 9,000 years. They know that 9,000 years ago people were living there. It's so desert now, people can't even live there now. So the whole African continent, we actually consider it the sacred hook that holds all the other continents together. So it's definitely a very powerful area, and there's certainly stone circles.
And also we're on the forefront of working with great musicologists like Ellis Coltrane and others.
There you go.
Who are part of our teaching and our work. So thank you very much for your contribution.
You're more than welcome.
Very good. Thank you for calling. I appreciate that. And let's go to another line. Here we have Restine calling on the first time caller line. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Los Angeles, California.
Okay, go ahead with the question.
Great. First I'd like to thank the Hertex for their great work. I tuned in and heard them talking about frequency and harmonic resonance and mathematics as it relates to the universe. And one thing I want to say, I'm a professional musician, and I play with a lot of top acts. But to move along, I began to search for something deeper after I started researching and finding how significant music was to the ancient Egyptians. And I recently composed some music using principles of numerology. And I studied how the numerology is very significant in many of the ancient cultures. I wanted to grab some of that energy and infuse it into the music. And I'd like to know if the Hertex could possibly elaborate on the significance of numerology in some of the ancient cultures. And I do have a CD that I would like to get to them for them to please review for me, because I'm really excited about some of the things that they're talking about.
Well, can they reach you through your website, Dr. Hertex?
That's
right. Go to futurescience.org or keysofenoch.org.
Okay.
Right. We do know that in ancient times, the mathematical patterns of 144-864-105-688-2368, et cetera, were connected with music harmonics, and these were used very extensively by composers, musicians, dancers in various parts of the world. In all major cultures, there is this musical rhythm that's very, very profound. And I do believe one of the missing pieces of archaeology, anthropology, is the whole musical architecture, how this connects with the raising of consciousness, the mental syntax, or some would call it the spiritual awakening that will be required to make, as it were, the point of shift that's coming. Thank you very much for suggesting that and sending that in our direction.
And again, for those of you who are interested, the two websites that you can access information on the Hertex writings and their research and their books, et cetera, is www.keysofenoch.org, and the other is www.futurescience.org.
One of our new albums we just came out with is called Secret Place by Jocelyn Smith, and she's a very famous singer. She sang before the Brandenburg Gate after 9/11, and she's marvelous. She's got one of the best voices in the world in her category, and she and others are taking the musical notations that we've investigated and putting this into the popular side of reaching out, hands across the ocean, hearts across the sea. We're trying to see how music vibrations of prayer and meditation can be used really to connect the different parts of the human race together on a higher level of what we believe to be the higher musical scripting that is part of the human evolution.
Fascinating. The whole thing is just fascinating. Let's go to Josie, east of the Rockies. Josie, where are you calling from?
Hi, hello, Barbara. Greetings to the Hertex.
Where are you?
Interesting things for you. The Society for Scientific Exploration. Have you heard about that?
There are several groups that call themselves Society for This or for That. Is this the one in Northern California or whereabouts?
Well, I mean, it is headquartered at the University of Virginia, but they have people, some of the guests from the shows have been on this.
What is your question, Josie?
Well, I have a point to make about my trip to Egypt, but I thought that because their stuff is so absolutely great, you guys, that you should maybe send a manuscript to them for their journal and perhaps maybe even might want to do presentations at some of their events. They're on scientificexploration.org, or John Anthony West is a member, so you perhaps can talk to him.
Thank you very much.
But here's my point on the Egypt, because in 1982, I had just not too long prior been at ARE in Virginia Beach and learned some of the ancient Egyptian chants. And so I found myself in one of those temples, one of those many that we went through. This one was the big one with Ramses in the front at Abu Simbel in Abydos. And I was in, as you go into the temple on the left, the last niche. You know, they had these little niches all along the sides of the temples. And the one on the left, closest to the altar, I started doing Areyom, Areyom, and then another one of the people from our group joined me, and we were both doing, you know, in kind of a low tones, we were doing Areyom, you know, kind of like that. And we were hearing a higher voice just outside singing the same thing, Areyom, and higher. And this, and I, so I'm, you may want to take note of that place. I don't know if it was the moon in the right phase or what was going on. However, when we looked out, it was not another tourist imitating us. There wasn't anybody there.
That's well, we've discovered all along the Nile that there, each of the temples represent a musical vibratory level that matches some part of the human anatomy.
Yeah, we consider the all the temples along the Nile being like this different chakra areas of the body. But what was interesting is it's exactly what happened to us in Tikal, where he, as a male voice, was doing one sound, and what we were recording on tape, in addition to his voice, was this higher frequency of almost a, sounded like a female singing, a very high female singing.
When that happens and you record it in different places, is the female voice or the higher voice that you hear exactly the same every time?
No, it was hitting different harmonics. So when he was going up, it wasn't always going up as high. Sometimes he was going up and it was going up higher. So it was doing this kind of unique, almost like someone else singing with him, but there really was nobody else in that area.
The question is, where did the paraphysical voice come from? And why is Tikal called the city of sound or vibration? So the ancients knew that the placement of these pyramidal temples were like musical notes in an orchestra arrangement, with the key musician or orchestrator or chanter hitting a certain note, things would fall in place, and they actually did at that particular time. And it's amazing. I've had the opportunity, having a musical background, to work with some very wonderful composers, and we are in touch with many fine researchers throughout the world who wanted to bring this out professionally through major film segments so that the people at large throughout the world can get the uplinks and downlinks through world satellites, and we can bring this music out in a dynamic way so that world at large can hear this music freely and openly.
It's fascinating. Could this type of vibration and sound have been a method of communication around the globe at a time when supposedly they didn't have the capacity to do that?
Well, again, the legends of Osiris said that he went literally throughout the world preaching, and he did it all through sound and music. So however we want to take that, and it could even be just higher frequencies of sound vibration. If he had the ability to literally travel, maybe even in certain types of vehicles, maybe he was able to put those sounds. Look at what's going on again with the crop circles. I mean, there's symbols, and all you need to do is see some of those symbols and start realizing that there's maybe something with sacred geometry. There's maybe something with higher vibrations, with magnetic fields, something
well,
that's creating.
Even the Dead Sea Scrolls have a text that speaks of the angelic names that will be sounded with the trumpets. So even if we look at our own traditional heritage in the West, or the heritages of the Near East or Africa or the Orient, we will see in the ancient scriptures a clear sound signal of reaching out and making that soundscape work on behalf of a human upliftment or transformation.
And of course, you have the legends throughout Egypt, and also even the concept of why in the Bible, when Jesus raised the dead, did he say certain words that are not really translated? It's because those names and those sounds have a certain vibration which help in bringing back the soul into a type of resurrection.
Wow, I hadn't heard that before. That's fascinating. Let's go to Michael, wildcard line. Michael, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Waterville.
Okay. Quick question, please, because we're really tight on time.
Yes. Okay. I don't have a question. I have a notation that you're a half note off on your scale. It's not do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do. It's sa, re, ga, ma, pa, da, mi, sa. And at the same time, that Steven Spielberg thing was translated in Sanskrit. It's Hari Shadarna.
Well, thank you very much, because it's true. The people from the East, especially the Hindus, have known about these sacred vibrations and sounds and been doing them for thousands of years, which I think has kept the culture in terms of a very, generally higher resonant vibration, being able to live in harmony, work in harmony. I know there's problems in the North, but for the most part, you have people like...
Into us on our webpage, futurescience.org.
Check the webpage.
I know we're running out of time, and the world waits. The coming together of the most exciting chapter of the human race, this Alpha and Omega coming together, the spiritual...
We're out of time, Dr. Hertak. I'm sorry, we're out of time. But check their websites, check their books, check their CDs, and you check Coast to Coast AM tomorrow night. George will be back, Art back next weekend. I'm Barbara Simpson. Thank you. It's been wonderful being with you again, and see you next time.